You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. A lot of people are looking forward to this weekend's release of Star Wars Episode 8, The Last Jedi. The new Star Wars trilogy has a Wisconsin connection. A UW alum works at Industrial Lights, at Light and Magic, the motion picture visual effects company founded by Star Wars creator George Lucas. She helps bring the movies to life. Rachel Rose studied computer science at UW-Madison. She's a research and development supervisor at Industrial Light and Magic. Rachel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Rob.
Well, you two paths came together for you, computers and Star Wars. Let's start with Star Wars. When did you first fall in love?
Oh, my gosh. That's a really hard question. It's kind of something that's always been with me since I was really, really tiny. I can remember, you know, having C-3PO sheets on my bed and playing with little star figures. And, but that moment when I first knew about Star Wars is kind of way too young for me to even remember.
And when did you first get into computer science?
So I was always really interested in computers. You know, when I was little, I would look at magazines about computers. And when I was in high school, we finally actually got one. I was a junior in high school. And I really was blown away by the types of things you could do with the computer. You know, you could ask it to do things, and it would actually follow your instructions. So when I went to college, I decided that I would try, you know, my hand at majoring in computer science. And it really opened my eyes to the world of possibilities. So I think, you know, a lot of things came together in those first few years of college when I really figured out that, you know, these computers could bring me to the life that I wanted and the type of job that I wanted in my future.
And a lot of us when we were young, I think, probably thought, I'm going to be a Jedi when I grow up or a Wookiee. And then we grew up and got a little more realistic and maybe thought, wow, could I maybe someday be involved in the story somehow? When did it first occur to you that, wow, these two things could come together for me?
You know, I would say that actually happened when I was in graduate school at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I'd gotten into computer graphics, which is one of the areas one of the main areas that our company is really invested in. I saw people doing what I was doing in graduate school coming to places like Industrial Light and Magic, and that opened my eyes to the possibilities of where I might be able to end up. I wouldn't say that I knew that I would end up here until probably the last year. I started kind of pushing for a job in this particular facility, and it's great. It worked out.
So I had moments early in my career where it was like, oh, wow, I'm about to start talking out into the radio. What was it like for you the first time you were sitting at a computer and realized I'm doing stuff that's going to be in the Star Wars movies?
It's hard to even mention when that time was. I know when I first got here and the first few shots kind of came across my desk, it was kind of amazing to look and say, wait a minute, these are all the things that I've always loved since I was a child, and I do this now. But at the same time, you're so tied up in trying to actually get your work done and the challenges of your work. So it's just those moments when you kind of look at what's on the screen and realize, you know, that's Star Wars. This is something that affects so many people.
We're talking to Rachel Rose. She works in Industrial Light and Magic on things like the Star Wars movies, and she's a UW-Madison alum. And Rachel, the legend around Star Wars and the special effects a lot of times is that, you know, they're not taking known materials and applying them to the movie. They're at Industrial Light and Magic kind of inventing the special effects as they go. And you've done some of that, as I understand.
Yeah, you know, we have a long tradition in the, you know, more than 40 years that Industrial Light and Magic has been around of really innovating both in the artistic ways as well as in technical ways. And over the last 10 years that I've been at the company, I've really looked into ways of expanding how we create the creatures that we create, because the creatures are really the part of the entire pipeline that I'm responsible for, but also in how we do what we call virtual production using our in-house toolkit called Stagecraft. The virtual production is really how do we make digital pictures in much the same way that we might make a live-action picture by using things like motion capture technology to drive what you see on the screen.
Right. I understand you were involved in things like virtual cameras where the director or, I guess, editor could move around the camera, kind of like they're physically moving it around in the real world, but within the computer landscape.
Yeah, you've got it exactly right. And, you know, in Rogue One, for instance, Gareth Edwards used a virtual camera that we had developed to help drive some of the really big space battle shots so that they felt more like the style that he might get on a real live-action set, but at a scale that's just not possible when you can't just carry a camera around in space that much size and vastness of the environment around you.
We hear a lot about the challenges facing women in, well, every field these days in America, but in technology fields in particular, computer sciences, Silicon Valley, what has it been like for you as a woman in that line of work?
You know, I've been really lucky. I think that I've had so many great supportive people around me, both my family and my friends, but also the wonderful other engineers that I work with. It's one of those things that kind of sometimes still surprises you. Since I've been doing this now for 10 years, I'm relatively confident in what I'm doing, but sometimes you're sitting in the room and you realize you're the only woman there. We have a long history of having great women within Industrial Light and Magic and Lucasfilm that help drive the company. But at the same time, you know, sometimes when you're doing your day-to-day job, you still want another woman around just to be able to see that there are other people like you. It's one of the reasons I feel pretty strongly that I want to be able to be in front of people and make sure that people know that there are other women doing this so that I can encourage women who might be thinking about it to go ahead and go for it.
Right. Theoretically, there's probably a girl out there with her own Star Wars sheets who might, in a few decades, be in your role.
Exactly. And that's exactly my thinking.
How about let's look at your time here in Wisconsin. What kind of impact did Wisconsin have on you and your career?
You know, Wisconsin was fantastic. I think that, the world-class professors and other students that are there really helped me make a lot of connections outside of the school itself. Those connections are really what allowed me to get to where I am, in addition to all of the other stuff that had happened in my past. Those connections allowed me to have people that were actually working at Industrial Light and Magic by the time I graduated, and I could connect with them, and that ultimately was able to put in a good enough word that I, got an interview, and then hopefully by the strength of my interview, we're able to actually get the job.
Now, the new movie comes out this weekend, and I understand you can't give any details about that. I understand that. But what is it like for you when you actually get to sit down in a full-size theater and watch your work on the screen?
It's amazing, and it's so great to watch it with a live audience and hear the excitement that people have when they finally see these films. I wouldn't trade it for the world. That part of it is just so great, the actual sharing of the things that you create.
And does it kind of spoil watching other movies for you? Are you able to just watch a movie if it's like a science fiction movie? Are you really like watching the special effects, seeing if they got it right or wrong?
You know, you'll notice those things because it's part of your job, but I'm a movie fan. It's one of the things that brought me here, and so it is easy to still lose yourself in a good story.
Well, Rachel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Rachel Rose, UW-Madison alum and a research and development supervisor at Industrial Light and Magic. She joined us to talk about her career in computer science and her work on the Star Wars franchise. People returning from military service can have a difficult time readjusting to civilian life. And one of the toughest challenges can be overcoming symptoms of trauma that come from the experience of war. A Wisconsin farm is working to do its part by providing victims of trauma, veterans and others, with equine therapy. Veterans Equine Trail Services in Laval is a nonprofit, volunteer-run farm that's helping veterans regain a sense of trust and purpose by working with rescued horses and other animals. The farm also works with survivors of abuse, people with physical disabilities, and the terminally ill. Barb Knopf founded Veterans Equine Trail Services with her late husband. She's also a disabled veteran of the United States Marine Corps. Barb, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, I can't thank you so much for the opportunity to address everybody with public radio. It's a great station, and we enjoy listening to it around the barn.
Oh, thank you so much. Well, Barb, what led you and your late husband to start a farm geared toward helping veterans and others dealing with trauma?
My son actually served in the United States Marine Corps and came back from his tours in Iraq and Afghanistan, a changed young man suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. And he assisted us with our horse rescue side of our farm and said, Mom, you really need to offer this to other veterans. This has helped me so much. It's calmed my nightmares. It's calmed my anxiety. It's given me determination and a sense of purpose by helping these abused horses that we have at the farm, because we are a Morgan Horse Rescue as well. And there's only two of us in the whole United States.
Can you talk about the journey when a veteran shows up, someone dealing with PTSD, what kind of things do they do? How do they build that relationship?
Well, just like with every individual animal and people, every personality and their needs are all different. So we assess both the veteran and our equine friends, our horse friends, and we find a partnership that will work on building trust from both the rescued horse and the veteran who's suffering, both emotionally and physically. And we bring the two together, and they work as a team, conquering small obstacles, building up to either riding or driving a carriage.
And you mentioned the word trust, and that's something that maybe for the person suffering trauma and certainly for the animal who's suffered from abuse or neglect, trust might be a tall order. How do you start to build that?
Well, they're both coming from an equal playing field. Neither trusts the other. And the horses are large. So when you can make a 1,000-pound animal partner up with you and do what you are asking to do, there is an invisible bond that starts there. And it starts with something as simple as brushing the horse, connecting with a live, breathing, warm animal, much like petting your dog or having your cat curl up in your lap and purr.
Barb, I want to ask, based on your own personal experience, did working with horses do a lot of these things for you before you were actually formally doing this equine therapy?
Yes, they have. I've been a United States Marine. I am a disabled vet. It was my unit that was killed in Beirut. I've been a postal carrier and was actually injured on the job by someone trying to steal mail. And throughout those traumas in my life, the horses have always offered me a relaxing place, a respite, light at the end of the tunnel, so to speak, and kept my heart really warm to wanting to reach out and help others. And we started with the horses, and it just continues to grow every year.
Did you grow up around horses, or was this something you came to later in your life?
My parents would tell you that my first ride on a horse was in a car seat because I was a colicky baby, and that cadence, that 1, 2, 3, 4 of the hoof movement quieted me. And after that, they couldn't keep me away from horses. I always had horse poop on my boots or on my sneakers and dirt under my nails.
And you said, I didn't know this, your unit was the one in the horrific Beirut bombing. I mean, that's for the people directly there, for the people affected that, the loss. I mean, that's a huge trauma to deal with.
It was a very large trauma. These were my brothers and sisters in arms. When you're in the service, your fellow service man, be it Army, Air Force, Marine Corps, Coast Guard, it doesn't matter. They become your extended family. And I have to say, as Marines, we become a very tight-knit group because we're one of the smallest armed services that we have within the United States. And our motto is always faithful. And so that Semper Fidelis goes a long way. So knowing people that you had read letters and shared homemade cookies with weren't coming back was very traumatic. It's like losing a loved one, losing a brother or a sister.
Now, Barb, if people think one word about Marines and other service members, it might be tough or self-reliant, something like that. And that's a value in many ways. But does it make it hard to recover, to say, hey, I've got a problem that I need some help with?
Well, because there's so many stigmas that go on with when you say post-traumatic stress disorder. It's marked down as a mental disability. And that in itself is a disabling label. Every man and woman who has ever served all the way back to biblical times has suffered from their time in service. Loss of friends, loss of, you know, our extended family passing away. Time away from our families while we serve our United States. You know, we lay it all on the line for the United States of America. Take our bodies, our souls, our hearts, our arms, whatever. And when we come back, we are very much changed. And many times we wall off our emotions to be able to go to war. And so when we come back, it's very hard to take that brick back off that wall and open back up. So we are very much changed, and equine therapy or horse therapy really helps renegotiate parts in our hearts and our minds and lets us start trusting and sharing what could be very dark memories and letting them come out and deal with them.
Is there something about working with an animal who's not going to judge you, who doesn't have that stereotype of you, that you can open up in a way that you might not be able to yet anyway with a human?
You know, it's wonderful. You can tell these horses anything you want to tell them. Your dirtiest, darkest secret, your envy, your whatever, and these horses won't tell anybody. And our volunteers are 99.9% veteran-based as well. Our board is made up of veterans. So when we say we understand, you might be Army, but as a Marine, I know what you went through. We have Vietnam-era veterans. We just lost our World War II vet. We have current conflict veterans as well. We even have wives of veterans that volunteer. So we really do understand what the veterans as well as their families go through.
We're talking to Barb Knopf. She's the founder, with her late husband, of the Veterans Equine Trail Services, providing a unique kind of therapy for veterans and other people who've been through some kind of trauma. Barb, I want to talk a little bit about the horses. How do you get connected with these horses and then bring them into this program?
Well, regretfully, here in Wisconsin, there are very few large animal shelters like your local SPCA or Humane Society. So farmers are often called on to house unwanted horses. We are specifically a Morgan horse rescue because there's only two, myself and one in Pennsylvania right now. And so we get calls from across the nation. So we may go to California next week if we're called. We've been to 11 states so far, rescuing horses, specifically Morgans, and getting them out of abusive and neglective situations.
And tell us about Morgan horses. What's unique about them?
Well, they're really cool animals. They came to light about 1786, just as the U.S. was getting its independence, and we had won there. And they were used by the United States Cavalry until the late 60s. And then they literally put these horses in a ditch and machine gunned them down so that the Army and all the other services would be more reliant on jeeps and motorized transportation. So this horse really helped win us our independence. It helped keep our nation safe, as well as making sure that, you know, the public had great riding and driving horses back in the day. So they even helped settle the West. So they're very linked to our history with our servicemen and women as well.
Now, you're located in Laval, as we mentioned, not too far from Reedsburg. What's community reaction and support been like for you?
You know, we get wonderful support from our local American Legion, our VFW halls, and, of course, the Marine Corps League. I happen to be the commandant of the Sauk County Marine Corps League, as well as other local civic groups. Regretfully, we are 100% supported by private donors, small grassroots grants, and these wonderful civilian organizations and military organizations that are willing to donate to us.
If people are out there thinking, hey, I've worked with horses, I'd love to get involved with this, do you have a need for more volunteers to work with the horses?
There is never enough volunteers, and they do everything from brushing, helping us feed, helping us rehab these abused horses, helping us saddle and bridle when we have the homeless vets, the mental health vets coming in from Tolma or Madison, or even our special needs kids, because we do cater to handicapped children as well, and we also work with our handicapped adults in our local area.
If people are out there who are in those categories, veterans or people with disabilities, and they think, hey, I might benefit from this, or a family member might, do you have room for more people using your service?
Absolutely. All they need to do is give me a call at 608-415-8965. 6'7", and that is my cell phone. It is on me 24 hours a day in case one of our veterans needs something that we can assist with. And we work with other veterans organizations, for instance, Veterans Assistance Foundation out of Tolma, trying to ride our homeless vets back into our communities as well.
You mentioned a feeling of a family, kinship among people in the service. And I got to watch a little bit of a video of you at work on the farm. And it definitely seems like humans and horses, there's definitely a sense of family going on there.
You know, these horses are so smart. If you come up for an extended period of time, they learn what your vehicle sounds like and looks like. And the horse that you're working with may hear or see you come in or hear your voice and actually run to the fence to meet you. So there really is a bond that comes there.
And this is something that you obviously love. This is something that keeps you really motivated, Barb.
You know, as a disabled vet, I have chronic reflex pain disorder. I also just suffered from bladder cancer and had my bladder removed 2 years ago. And even my husband's loss in July. These horses have kept me sane. They've kept me grounded. They give me a sense of purpose. And being able to give back to others in the community and let them know they are not alone in this fight. It is a long-term disability that can flare at different times in their lives. And we are there at the Vets Program for them.
Barb, good luck with the program. Thanks for joining us, and thanks for the work you're doing.
Well, I appreciate it immensely. And if somebody would like to donate funds, if they'll call me, I will give them an address. You need someone to talk at your civic group, please give me a call. We can do that as well.
That's Barb Knopf. She's the founder of Veterans Equine Trail Services in Laval. That's a nonprofit farm helping people overcome the effects of trauma by working with horses and other animals. You can find out more. You can go to veteransequinetrailservices.org. Do we have that up on the Ideas Network Facebook page? We can get it up on the Central Time Facebook page for you. Now, President Trump and other Republicans are questioning the integrity of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation. The criticism followed the release of text messages between FBI officials who used to be on Mueller's team. In the messages, one of the officials called Trump a, quote, loathsome human and more. But other analysts say Mueller's critics might be trying to discredit the investigation before there are any findings that could implicate the president. Lowell Barrington is an associate professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at Marquette University. He joins us now for a closer look at the story. Lowell, welcome back.
Good afternoon, Rob.
Well, what do you make of efforts by some Republicans in Congress, among others, to create doubts about this Mueller investigation, especially surrounding these texts?
Well, I think there are a few different ways to think about that, and one is what's being said and maybe what the actual goal is. I'm not sure even the House Republicans actually want Mueller fired, but I think you're correct that there is a sense that they are trying to discredit him and the investigation to weaken its impact, including when additional charges or indictments would come out in the months ahead. And so I think it's in some ways, even though it's really sounding like they're trying to help President Trump with the idea of firing Mueller, I think they really just are trying to discredit him in the short run.
And these texts between two of the FBI officials who had been involved in this investigation, and at least one of them in investigating Hillary Clinton previously, a lot of unflattering things said in these texts about Donald Trump, some about Bernie Sanders, former Attorney General Eric Holder, one about Chelsea Clinton. I mean, they were going after a lot of different people here. But in general, what do you make of the idea of looking at these sort of personal back and forths and then applying them to, did this bias the investigation?
Well, and the last part of your question is the key. I think it's unfortunate in some ways that they were texting this way. On the other hand, people have conversations in the workplace or outside the workplace all the time in this way. And I think we'd have to say that many of the FBI and people in justice were probably saying unflattering things about Hillary Clinton during the campaign as well. And I think this is somewhat normal behavior for people in their private conversations. That said, the question is, did it or has it affected the investigation in any way? And I don't think there's any evidence of that at this point, and certainly not any evidence that this should reflect, you know, on Mueller himself. And I think the testimony yesterday where Rosenstein basically expressed his strong support in Mueller is, at this point, where I think a lot of people are in both the Democratic Party and even a lot of Republicans.
Let's give a listen here to Rod Rosenstein from the Justice Department in that testimony you just mentioned.
Based upon his reputation, his service, his patriotism, and his experience with the department and with the FBI, I believe he was an ideal choice for this task.
So Rod Rosenstein talking about Robert Mueller there. There's no, it doesn't seem like there's any indication from the Justice Department that they're going to try to step on this investigation or stop it or investigate it, as some Republicans are calling for. Is that right?
I think that's right. I think to the extent that there could be any kind of investigation, it might be a congressional committee investigation looking into some of these individuals. Peter Sturzok, for example, who was one of the people with the texting that you mentioned, I think that there could be hearings and things like that beyond what we've already seen. But it would be a really huge surprise to me, at least, if Rosenstein were to authorize and select a special counsel, a second special counsel, to essentially investigate the investigation.
Democrats are saying, hey, why did the Department of Justice release these texts to the media? They, not all of them in their collection, but they showed, I think, a few hundred texts to members of the media. Democrats saying, shouldn't we keep that quiet? This is an investigation that shouldn't be leaked to the media in this way.
Well, and I think it is fair to say it's unprecedented that this happened, but that doesn't mean it's automatically a wrong or bad decision. I think that Rod Rosenstein was in a very tough situation. So if it had come out, for example, that he had these texts and had basically been sitting on them and refused to let people know, then he himself could be charged with sort of hiding things that were going on in the investigation. So I don't think in an ideal world you bring in the media in the way they did and go through the text with them. But again, if you think of putting yourself in Rod Rosenstein's shoes, he certainly had a very difficult choice to make there, and I think was probably erring on the side of wanting to be as open and transparent as he could be.
That's interesting. It's a similar dilemma as a former FBI director James Comey had, where in some cases he was criticized for speaking publicly about where an investigation was, and if he hadn't, he would have been subject to criticism for keeping it quiet, especially in the midst of a presidential race.
I think that's right, and I think it's also important, just as a sort of thinking about this in a balanced way, to remind people that Democrats were very critical of Comey's FBI investigation of Hillary Clinton's emails, both kind of originally and I think especially when he decided very late in the campaign to announce that he was reopening that investigation. And there were certainly some implied bias in Comey in their criticisms of him. So it is something, again, that we've seen before, where people who don't like the direction that an investigation is going, that they will attack the investigator or attack the process to try to weaken the legitimacy of that investigation. I will say I don't think it's working, at least at this point. I think it plays well to a certain small group of people who are hearing a lot of information about the backgrounds of the people on Mueller's team, on their spouses, things like that. I think that there is a group to which what was said at the Judiciary Committee oversight hearing yesterday, that certainly would ring true to a lot of people. But the evidence, at least from the general public, is that this is not working. And in fact, they're, at least at this point, quite supportive of both the investigation and specifically of Mueller.
We're talking to Lowell Barrington from Marquette University. He's at the Department of Political Science there, looking at the latest in Robert Mueller's Russia probe. And Lowell, let's get to the state of where we are in this investigation. The last bit of dramatic news, it's been, 10 days or so. Michael Flynn pleaded guilty on one count and is cooperating now with the Mueller probe. We haven't seen much since then, but what are you watching for when it comes to Flynn?
Well, that was a really important situation and development. I think a lot of people had thought that in a lot of ways Flynn was one of the big fishes that Mueller was going after by talking to other people. So the fact that there was a plea deal and at least a rather minimal charge compared to certainly what he could be charged with. And I would add, we don't quite know whether this is the only thing that Michael Flynn will be charged with. I think there could certainly still be additional charges, and that may be part of what Mueller is also holding over him. But, I think it's bad news for people around President Trump. This is somebody who was really in the middle of a lot of conversations and actions about Russia. And so for him to be cooperating with the Mueller investigation, I think I would be pretty nervous if I was a number of top administrative officials, including the president, but certainly also, Jared Kushner and even perhaps Vice President Pence.
In the Washington Post today, there was a report looking at how President Trump has treated the one of the core issues in the Mueller probe, Russian interference in the election last year. And the running theme is, for the most part, he has not acknowledged that. He's denied it in most cases publicly, very much so privately. There's been no high-level cabinet discussion of how do we handle potential future Russian interference in American elections. Is that something that worries you, whether or not it affected the election last year, that there isn't a big effort to stop it for the future?
It certainly worries me. I think that what we've seen from Russia is that they're willing to engage in this kind of activity, be pretty creative with it using social media, but also, really also poking and probing and testing and seeing what they can do and get away with, that we could see them try something like this again in 2018 or even 2020 for the next presidential election. So I think all of us should be concerned if the administration and Congress are not taking this issue seriously. I do feel like a lot of people in Congress, including on the Republican side, are taking it seriously, but it would help if the administration was as well.
And then another facet of this is the question, was there collusion, cooperation between the Trump campaign and someone connected with Russia and hacking and campaign interference? We don't know a lot of what's going on behind the scenes at the Mueller probe. From what's out there in the public eye, do you think that's a case that is being made?
Well, I think we have to think about three different areas that Mueller's looking at. And I would add collusion is not always the right term, and certainly for something where he would be trying to make a case for illegal activity. The crime is actually conspiracy, which would be conspiracy to commit a crime and take some action toward engaging in that crime. So collusion itself, if people are just talking, that is not something that would be criminal. It could be something that could still be used perhaps in an impeachment case. But as a criminal act, the key is whether there was conspiracy to commit a separate crime, in that ability to work together, that effort to work together. The second one is the obstruction of justice one, and that's one that I really feel like the investigations seem to be focusing a little more on in the last few weeks, including surrounding Flynn and that kind of timeline in the period before and after his firing. I think in some ways there is an effort to continue to work on that case. And then the third one that we just can't forget, and if you had read the Manafort indictment and the Rick Gates indictment, it's hard to forget it at this point, but the financial crimes question is still in play. And Mueller is authorized to follow, these threads as he starts pulling and seeing what he finds. And I think there should be real concern by both the president and people around him that they're can be potential problems down the road here in terms of things related to tax evasion or money laundering.
We're talking to Lowell Barrington, chair of the Department of Political Science at Marquette University. We're looking at the criticism that Special Counsel Robert Mueller and the Russia investigation are receiving from some Republicans in Congress and the wider issues surrounding the investigation. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions and your thoughts. Are you worried about potential political bias in the Russia investigation? Do you think these criticisms from the president and some Republicans in Congress are valid? What are you watching for in the wider investigation? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We're continuing the conversation with Lowell Barrington, chair of the Department of Political Science at Marquette University. We're looking at the latest on the Russia investigation after some Republicans accuse it of being politically biased. You can join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Do you think Special Counsel Robert Mueller is doing a good job on the Russia investigation? Is he the right person to be leading this? Do you think Republicans should be questioning whether there's political bias or conflict of interest in the investigation? What are your thoughts? What are your questions? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And Lowell, just a few moments ago, you were talking about the financial side of this investigation. President Trump has said, hey, this is about collusion, which we didn't do. Going into the Trump Organization's finances is off limits, is it?
Well, I think the evidence from the Manafort indictment is that it's not off limits, that in fact following the trail as new things come up in the Mueller investigation, he is allowed under the guidelines that were set up with the special counsel creation by Rod Rosenstein to follow those things that he finds. And I think it's hard to imagine that there would not be anything of interest to him, again, in areas of financial misdeeds, whether tax evasion or money laundering. And I think that's backed up by things that he's done, working with the IRS's criminal division, working with the New York State Attorney General, who has significant powers in the area of financial crimes compared to most states' attorney general. And I think the other one in this case would just be that we have a pretty good idea, I think, at this point, based on the number of documents that there was a leak recently about the number of documents and things that Mueller has collected, the number of electronic devices that they have seized, that he's looking for more than just a real narrow obstruction of justice at this point.
And I understand some bank records from a German bank are part of this investigation now?
That's correct. And again, that would be consistent with trying to understand from Mueller's standpoint even if we're going to just stick with connecting it to Russia, whether there had been financial dealings and ties between Russians and Trump in a way that might have compromised him and might have led him perhaps down this path of frankly, what sometimes is puzzling to a lot of people, as you were talking about before, why he seems so unwilling to even acknowledge things that his own intelligence community have made quite clear.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Elaine is with us in Colfax. Elaine, hi.
Hi. I just had two comments, or a quick one, that I think Mueller is excellent, and I don't think it's been mentioned that he is a Republican lifelong. And the second comment I had is that during the campaign, Comey emphasized the problems with Clinton's email over and over and over again, but failed to mention that Trump's campaign was being investigated for ties to Putin or Russia. And I just wondered if your guest could comment on that, that he basically just made it one-sided when there was a lot going on in the investigative area of the FBI.
Elaine, thanks for that call. So, Lowell, we heard about the Clinton emails. We didn't hear so much about the FBI investigations of Putin and the Trump campaign.
Right. Let me start with Elaine's second point there. I think it's important to remind people of that. I think there was an explanation that Comey provided that he felt like the information about the Clinton investigation was going to be leaked if he did not come out with it, and he wanted to kind of control the message to an extent about that investigation. He apparently did not feel like that was likely to happen in the case of the investigation that was going on of Donald Trump. I think it's still fair to ask, if you're trying to be, as he has tried to portray himself as being politically neutral and kind of apolitical in these investigations, why he didn't raise that publicly when he was talking about the investigation of Hillary Clinton. I think that's a fair question, and it's one I think, again, we have at best a partial answer to from James Comey. I want to say something about her first point, too, about Robert Mueller. His reputation is stellar, and I think when Rod Rosenstein was talking about him as not just someone with great experience, but his patriotism and dedication to the country, I think that's something, again, that people on both sides of the political aisle understand, despite some of the comments yesterday. I think that's really well accepted. And one of the examples I'd give, he was a Republican, looks like, in his background, but he was certainly appointed by a Republican president. And then his term was extended by President Obama that did require a vote in the Senate, which was 100-0. So, I mean, this is somebody, again, that both sides of the aisle previously had said, you know, is really beyond attack in this way.
Elaine, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Peter on the line in Plainfield. Peter, hi.
Hi. I'm wondering about the Trump dossier, and, you know, it describes all the horrible things that Trump and his wife did concerning disrespecting Obama and Michelle. Where did this dossier come from? And is that the basis of the original investigation, in your opinion?
Peter, thanks for bringing that up. It's a long and complicated story in some ways, Lowell. What do you think of the role of that, the Steele dossier?
Well, I think it's been brought into the investigation from time to time. And in fact, I think even Steele himself said he thinks it's probably only about 80% correct. And that's not unusual when you're given the task, as he was, and paid to collect this information. You talk to a lot of people and you put together a kind of tentative set of findings, some of which would work out and some of which would not. I don't think it was the basis for the investigation. I think that, again, it certainly... the FBI intelligence community certainly had it, and I think we know that. But the investigation was in many ways sparked by, the kindling was there, but sparked by Comey's firing, and again the significant evidence from the intelligence community of actions by Russia during the campaign.
Peter, thanks for that call. I want to talk about the presidential pardon power, Lowell. The president could pardon people for federal crimes like Michael Flynn. But there's been talk that, hey, we're leaving some charges. Maybe they're leaving charges for a state prosecutor to file that would be not subject to that pardon power. Is that something you're watching for?
I think we are. And I think, again, especially because of Mueller's team's work with the New York Attorney General, I think that we would, and again, this relates also to the question of what happens if Mueller is fired, which, again, as I think we had talked about previously, I still don't think is likely to happen. There's some thought that President Trump could just go in that direction, and it would be difficult, though, because really Rod Rosenstein would have to be the one to make that decision, and if he wouldn't, he would essentially have to be replaced by someone who would make that decision. So I do think it's unlikely, but if it were to happen, we not only have the investigation continuing because of the work with the state attorney general in New York at the state level, but as you said, the pardon power that the president has for people does not extend to state crimes. So the only way that at that point, if state charges were filed, that someone could be pardoned of that would be by a governor of a state, and that would be very unlikely in the case of New York.
Briefly, Lowell, what is the next next bit of news that you're watching for in this story?
I think, again, we're all just waiting for the next charge or the next piece of information about what has actually been put together. It's really important to remind ourselves we know a few drops in the bucket of what the Mueller team knows, and we learn things as people are questioned. So we knew that, for example, many of the recent interviews were focusing on this period of time around when Michael Flynn was fired, which made people think again about obstruction of justice more than some other things at that point. So we can sort of find things here and there. But until you see a plea deal or an indictment document come out, I think it's hard to know exactly what's coming next. Again, I would say we should be thinking about obstruction of justice. We should be thinking about conspiracy charges. And certainly, again, keeping in mind that it should not surprise anyone if there are financial charges brought. And again, that would not
and
just be...
I'm going to have to jump in. Thanks to Lowell Barrington from Marquette University, looking at the latest on the Russia probe.